Hi everyone, I'm Manny, and you're listening to Bayan Bayou with Manny. This 7-episode podcast on anti-Asian hate, being Cambodian, and COVID-19 gives voice to Khmer 1.5 and second generations who are championing change in a time of racial divide in America. These stories showcase their unique journey of struggles and successes to make a difference in a country in which they call home. Today I'm talking to Solie Soreau. She holds a PhD in education and organizational leadership from the University of Laverne, and she is the first Cambodian American woman elected to Long Beach City Council. She recently introduced the anti-hate resolution item against the city's Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders communities. She's a woman on a mission, looking to pave a new path for stronger community support and helping other Cambodians run for U.S. public office. Councilwoman Solie, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. First of all, congratulations on winning the November 3rd election to represent the city's 6th district.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. What was it that was in your campaign that most helped you win? And what are some of the reactions so far from the Cambodian community?
Yeah, so we had, the only reason why I am a councilwoman is because of community support. The Cambodian community, you know, the labor community, so many different communities that came together for my campaign because I was running against a 13-year incumbent who's been there for many years. And the response have been amazing, as much as I can get them in person or at least over the phone, because when I won, it was during the kind of the pandemic, right, when that occurred. Mm-hmm. And kind of leading up to this point to getting into office during the pandemic. But people are so proud. The older generation, our elders, are so proud to see the next generation moving forward to being able to be in these, especially a council seat that represents the largest Cambodian community in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, you're paving the way, and that's wonderful. Take us to the 6th district that you serve. Who are these people? Are they rich? Are they poor? What's their ethnicity? And what kind of issues are they mm-hmm. struggling with daily?
Yeah, so the 6th district is really like the center of the city. I like to think it's the heart of the city, but unfortunately it has the most disparity, where it has the highest number of people living in poverty. The rates of violence is high. You know, the business corridor has been struggling, and, you know, violence is really at an all-time high at the moment with the shootings that's increased across the nation. So, but, you know, in contrast to that, we also have a lot of great things, which is the diversity of our district. We have, in addition to Cambodians, we have a historic African-American community that established itself there. You know, many have know who Snoop Dogg is, who have grown up in a studio called VIP Records mm-hmm. that's in the district. We also have Jenny Rivera, who's a very famous Latina singer who's grown up in this district. So we have a large Latino population, as well as we also have our Caucasian community out here in a neighborhood called the Wrigley area. So it's very diverse, and we also have a lot of talent and assets in this district that I just can't wait to lift up.
That's wonderful. As you mentioned earlier, you came into office during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. You also inherited problems of homelessness in Long Beach and a poor healthcare system to the Cambodian community. What other problems are you faced with in your role as councilwoman?
Well, I think that in addition to homelessness, is the skyrocketing in housing prices. So rents an all-time high. In addition to you know, the violence I mentioned earlier that's increased, gun violence to various types of crime, and it's a trend that's increased across the United States. So that's definitely it. And, you know, unemployment has increased as well due to the pandemic. And, you know, again, I mentioned earlier, a challenged business quarter in all aspects because of the pandemic too.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of changes are you looking to institute that were not introduced by your predecessor?
Well, I think that part of the whole premise for running was that I want to make sure I am responsive that to a lot of the issues that range from, you know, things from getting people's potholes fixed to ensuring that we have violence prevention program and pathways for people through vocational training and employment opportunities, intentionally setting them up to occur, as well as supporting our business corridor. A lot of our business owners are immigrants who need support, and they need a variety of support. And we're going to be getting, we introduced a recovery. We have a recovery fund that in Long Beach that we're going to be, you know, setting up to do to support businesses and even people who are emerging to want to be entrepreneurs even despite this challenging time, as well as making sure that we have really supportive programs to encourage and inspire residents to clean and take care of each other and support each other as well.
And how is business in Long Beach? Is it business as normal or is it in partial shutdown?
No, California has reopened completely. And obviously it's still recommended that people wear their mask, but it's not being required. Or and so we're it's slowly opening up in that all the businesses are open, but I think slowly figuring out how to get back on their feet. And so we're at a critical point where support is definitely needed to ensuring a successful recovery.
Coming up, Sully says she wants to lift the Cambodian community in Long Beach by helping them to exercise their civic rights.
But it's a level of getting involved civically in voting and saying, no, we need these things too at a even local level. And that is kind of where, you know, my work is inspired, is really from the struggle that our community has gone through from the war to resettlement and ensuring that we have a voice to address the needs that we have.
In addition to holding a PhD in education, you also teach community organizing at the School of Social Work at Cal State LA. What made you want to advocate for others?
So I do want to clarify that I have a doctorate in education. It's an EdD, just so that, you know, it's just to clarify. And then I'm not teaching any longer just because it was hard to juggle currently right now as with a full-time job with a state agency and then a council member. But teaching has been just an extension of what I've been wanting to do to ensure that we continue to educate and support the next generation to serve your community and to care about your community and also have the tools and the knowledge of the history of what the United States, how it's shaped up to be this way. You know, nothing happens on its own without fighting and struggling for change. And that's what I think students need to know, is that America has been a country and where it's shaped because of democracy that we have, right? Mm-hmm. A voice that you have civically to make those changes. And so really, if you're not involved or you're not speaking up or you're not keeping up to date about what's going on, you're kind of excluded, right, from this process.
So that's your motivation, right? To speak up, to advocate for self and others.
Absolutely. And I really think that, you know, that's been the challenge with our community and the Cambodian community, is that, you know, so for so long since we've been here, it's about survival and just trying to make sure to pay the bills and put food on the table. But I think that we're in a place where we're getting to, I think, a point where it's no longer just survival in the sense of going to work and you know, but it's a level of getting involved civically in voting and saying, no, we need these things too at a even local level. And that is kind of where, you know, my work was inspired, is really from the struggle that our community gone through from the war to resettlement and ensuring that we have a voice to address the needs that we have uniquely, right?
Right. And you bring a unique perspective as a former Cambodian refugee. Now, you are a resident, an advocate, and an insider to the roughly 20,000 Khmer people living in Long Beach. What is your observation? Are they thriving or merely surviving? What's going on?
Yeah, I do want to just mention the number of Cambodians. It's always hard with the number because it's census-based, but, you know, some have thrown in 60,000, some have thrown others. So it's really hard, right? Because we always try to get people to fill out the census. But but I do want to say that there's, just like all community, we all have different, you know, socioeconomic status and different groups in our community. So I would say that, yes, we do have populations in our community that are struggling, that are living in pure poverty, that do need assistance. But there are also those who are immigrants that came here more recently and not in a refugee status that had maybe a little bit more resources and support resettling in America, right? There's Cambodian businesses and shops set up when they came versus refugees. So it's I think it depends on when you came to America and how you came, which sometimes determines your economic status or socioeconomic status. But I would say that we have a mix. Just like myself, I'm a second generation. I'm you know, doing well in the sense that I'm not, you know, I'm middle class. And but at the same time, I don't want to forget those who are struggling, that especially our seniors and those who, you know, are still having challenges.
Right. In your opinion, what are the challenges faced by immigrants? Is it education, finding employment, or something else? What are your thoughts on this topic? Because according to the latest findings by the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center, CRAC, only 17% of Cambodian Americans have a bachelor's degree or higher, compared with 54% of Asian Americans overall. As an educator, what could we do differently to change these statistics?
Yeah, I think that it has to do with the things that other communities face, is the way that we resettled here. And there are many who, you know, adults who came here didn't have the opportunity to go into higher education. And so when you're living in an area of poverty, limited in opportunities and educational pathways, it creates a cycle of poverty, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that to address that, that has to be a number of approach, which is support for the parents to ensure that they're able to have a job. And if they can, move up in their position to increase their pay or train in different jobs that pay higher. And then with young people, it's ensuring they have a pathway to either education or employment. And that requires support, right? On a on a mentorship level, to also an employment pathway level, right? Sometimes we all have gotten job because of people we know. But if you don't know people who are able to get you into certain positions, then you're kind of really left with the options that your parents know, right? And so that kind of keeps that cycle going. And so I really think that that's kind of where it's really crucial that we have different working in partnership with nonprofits to the city that are getting programs and different support, working with the schools too, to ensure that we're getting people on track or giving them opportunity they wouldn't otherwise be familiar with. But at the end of the day, it takes that individual to be able to, you know, be inspired to work hard and to keep on that path too, right? And unfortunately, sometimes people fall into the wrong path, but hopefully there are other avenues set up to support them, right?
Coming up, Sully says putting a stop to the deportation of Cambodian refugees convicted of common crimes in the United States is on her to-do list.
I care about this issue deeply. I think that it impacts my generation, who are the 1.5, the 2, that made a mistake and shouldn't be punished to this level for it, since many of them served their time, right? So I am working with advocate groups and nonprofit groups, organizing groups, to think through in ways that we can deal with those who are in the removal process, and also looking to see how we can change this systematically as well.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about people falling into the wrong crowd. In addition to education and lack of job opportunities and advancement, there is also the problem of deportation. As you know, up until now, more than 700 Cambodians have been deported from the United States since the country has signed a repatriation agreement with Cambodia in 2002. And as of 2017, about 1,900 Cambodian Americans have final orders of removal, meaning that they can be deported from the United States at any time. What are your thoughts on this? How can we bring this number down?
So I just want to share, I've been working on the issue of deportation of Cambodians pretty much when the MOU was signed, when I was working with a nonprofit called Khmer Girls in Action. And at that time, it was unfortunate that so many people didn't quite understand what was happening, right? Because they didn't understand the legal aspect that when a non-citizen, a green card holder commits a crime, that would be a misdemeanor, becomes a felony, and that, then that you were deportable. And so it became a really confusing process, and we were trying to help the family, and most of them were single mothers, right? That we were working with, single parent and mostly single moms who had their oldest son that they helped, you know, that survive with them to come to the U.S., thrown into the system, right? Meanwhile, dealing the layer of issue we just mentioned around working and just trying to survive and living in a safe environment. And it was really hard making sure they were getting the proper legal services and advice, and then providing them the support even when they got deported. So there are programs set up, and we're still certainly dealing with that to this day, 20 years still later, right? After or more since it's been signed, and continuing to work with our different, you know, advocates that we can help to get a pardon through the state, which is what I did when I worked for State Senator Ricardo Lara, is we would help write letters to support the pardon, have the governor pardon them. But that's not a systemic solution, right? That's something we can only do case by case. Mm-hmm. So, but I am very much, I care about this issue deeply. I think that it impacts my generation, who are the 1.5, the 2, that made a mistake and shouldn't be punished to this level for it, since many of them served their time, right? So I am working with advocate groups and nonprofit groups, organizing groups, to think through in ways that we can deal with those who are in the removal process, and also looking to see how we can change this systematically as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think as long as Cambodia still open its doors to deportees, this could be a long process.
Yeah, and it has been. But I do know that at least there's more education about the impact of this problem now than there used to be. And so I believe that we can keep doing is continue to fight against it, because when we stop, that's when it's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. That's when we give up.
Yes. And that's not okay. We can't. We got to keep trying.
Yeah. This brings me to your own immigration story. You were born in a refugee camp in Thailand. How old were you when you arrived in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I was born in Mai Rot, a refugee camp. I came here when I was 2 years old. We arrived in San Diego. And, you know, like many other families who resettled in the early 80s, as we came and we lived with other family members to be able to survive. And then we resettled into Los Angeles because my parent was looking for work, and the closest work they could find was working in the sweatshops in downtown LA fashion district. So, you know, many have really moved around where the work is.
Like many other newly settled families, your parents had to take whatever jobs they could to support the family.
Yeah. And then my mom ended up not working because they felt that somebody had to be home with us because my oldest brother, you know, being the oldest, like what we were just talking about earlier, of those who are going through deportation, you know, join a gang in order to be able to be part of a group, to be protected and feel like you're, you know, you have with his friends that he made. And so that was a challenge, right? Having one person working and then at that time living on welfare as well.
Your experience is relatable to some of the Cambodians living in Long Beach. You came from a one-income household. Your brother joined a gang and your family needed financial assistance from the government. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I find you to be somewhat of an outlier. Not only are you the first person in your family to go to college, but you pursued 3 degrees, one of which being a PhD. When did this shift happen for you?
Yes, I would agree I'm an outlier, but I think it also had to do with, I think, my spirit and always fighting and saying, no, that's not okay at a very early age, because I think that while I didn't understand how the system worked, I knew that the system wasn't working for us, because I think when you're children of immigrants or refugee, you become the interpreter for your parents. So I was put into a strange situation where I had to interpret or figure out situations and circumstances for my parents and my mom. And so I learned at an early age to advocate and knew that I had to keep pressing when something wasn't working. So that's how I ended up getting into the honors classes, even though I never got tested as gifted, because I really was adamant about that, because I knew that they were probably getting a better education than me, and then fought to get into college and just kept pursuing that pathway, because I knew that if I kept going at it, I would head in the right direction to at least improving something for myself or my community. And unfortunately, I didn't have mentors that really, like, I always hear these stories about people with these mentors that really helped groom and shape them to be on a path towards their career or to beat the odds. If there are people who are listening that are like me who didn't have that, you know, you can still pursue a pretty good future, just making sure that. But what I did have was a lot of different mentors when I needed it, or when I needed advice, I would seek them out, right? When I didn't understand something or needed perspective. So I didn't have one, but I had many.
Right. So it's also like that idea that if you don't know, ask.
Absolutely. Or if you don't have the answer, somebody does. And I never accepted no for any answer. If I didn't like it from one person, I would go somewhere else. It was really just always, you know, this is not what I want. I need to keep pursuing what I want kind of process.
Right.
Or it's not working and I need to make sure it works.
And what pushed you to thrive in America?
You know, I've been thinking a lot, because, you know, our parents' experience, our community experience is so much a part of who we are, that I carry that with me. And even at a young age, I kept thinking about, well, what's my purpose, right? What am I here to do? My parents survived this genocide and helped us resettle. What's my purpose? And I always felt like there needed to be this sense of justice done. And I always defined that as, you know, improving our family situation so that I could serve our community as well. And then became bigger and, well, how do I just serve in general and to improve the lives of people who live in this disparity that had barriers in their opportunities? So that's kind of really what inspires me every day, is this idea of seeking justice, which means to fight for equity, to fight for opportunities for those who are, don't have that or don't have the means to do so, and just speaking up for those who are, you know, are disadvantaged and oppressed.
You're right. It's being of service to others. Coming up, Sully tells us that success in navigating life starts with having a plan and reaching out to others for help.
And I think that that's the purpose that people have to hold on to really dearly in order to be able to achieve where you want to go, because it's so hard to see into the unknown in the future, right? Because you're facing with the difficulty right in front of you.
To society, you are a great example of the model minority in America. What's your take on this label so often assigned to Asian Americans? Is it damaging or unrealistic, or is it good?
Yeah, I think that that is, in my opinion, damaging, because it really then, I think that it really hides the disparity that Asian Americans face, as in that, you know, this model minority myth was developed when during the 60s and the 1960s, I believe, when there were selected immigrant groups that were allowed into the country, that were highly educated, that were brought here for educational and academic purpose, that they came to school here to go back to the homeland to help bring that skill back. So it created this perception that all Asians are only, you know, those kind that were coming at a large number, when it hides away the impact what had happened to many Asian and Pacific Islander immigrants when they immigrate to the U.S. is that there are layers of war and disparities that is part of the community that becomes a barrier, right? And health issue. Such as the challenge we face as Cambodians are very different from those who are from China that came, right? Because of the genocide that we experienced. Mm-hmm. So it kind of creates this blanket identity that's not necessarily true, that I think prevents resources from being allocated to the API community that's needed.
Right. It's not representative of all Asian Americans.
No. And I think that in every racial group and community, we have our very successful, very intelligent, but that doesn't become the stereotype of those race, right? And I think that we should be cautious of these stereotypes that are created, because it's not necessarily true. Right. It's not true.
And even if it's meant as a compliment, it's not, it could be damaging as well.
Absolutely. I think it is.
Let's talk about race in America. As a minority and as a woman of color, did you experience racism? And if you did, what experience with racism made the greatest impression on you?
Well, I think that, when we talk about racism, there are so many layers that are attached with it, also with our identity as a woman too, right? So yes, the racism in that, when people meet me, they didn't know, you know, the compliments about your English is so good to, you know, various body language that occurs when you're around. And I think that there's a layer of being a woman that adds sexism to it in various workplace and settings around assumptions of who you are. And I think that obviously that is really hard to deal with. And you know, you think about, well, how do you respond to it? And oftentimes Asian people don't say anything because they don't want to create conflict. But I have tried to figure out, determine when is it a battle I want to pick, but as more of an educational opportunity, and more so that I've learned to use it to my advantage in that, you know, they can make the assumptions they want about me, but they'll find out very soon it's not what it is. So I don't always feel like it's up to me to have to educate people on those things, but I do call it out when I see it now, as opposed to before, right?
Right. I think more people are feeling empowered to call out racism when they see it.
Or even identify what it is, mm-hmm. right? Because sometimes it's hard to say, is that racism, or is that because they're just a terrible person, or they're just being weird, right? So I think that that's kind of where, as I've gotten older, obviously learned to identify and understand what they are, and have the sophistication, I think, at this point to be able to call it out in a way where it isn't. So that is productive, right?
Mm-hmm. In March, you introduced the anti-hate resolution item against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders at the Long Beach City Council. Were there incidents that prompted you to introduce this? And what can you tell us about this initiative?
Well, I think that at that point when I was planning on introducing it, there has been a whole year of ongoing rise in hate crime against Asians specifically, right? And I really felt like while we didn't have cases being reported in Long Beach, it was really important that we as a city condemn it and acknowledge it, so that it doesn't occur in the city. But what was chilling is the night I introduced that item, just an hour earlier, or just even during the council meeting, was informed by our chief of police the mass shooting occurred in Atlanta. Yeah, just like right before I was going to introduce it, so it wow. couldn't have been more timely to introduce that item as it rose to that level, right? So, and I think that it's also for me to let a lot of our Asians as well as our Pacific Islanders know that that we see you and we know this is happening and we as a city support you. And so that was really important for me during this challenging time, that we as a city stood up for the community.
Take me to that moment when you were about to introduce this resolution and the shooting spree occur at three massage parlors in Atlanta, Georgia. How did the news affect you?
Oh, I mean, it shook me to my core when I was about to introduce it. It was just, I literally teared up. I was about to cry when he told me, because it's just so chilling that I was just about to talk about this item. And then for that to occur, I mean, 8 people got killed, you know, 6 of them were Asian women. You know, so many things run through your head in that. This is outrageous that it's gotten to this heightened level, right? And then it goes into, well, it could have been our family member. It could have been anybody, right, that we knew.
Right. What were some of the reactions from the Cambodian community in Long Beach? Were they afraid that they might be targeted, or did they feel removed from the incident?
No, I think that we all felt it was an attack on all of us. And, you know, right after that incident, the next day or two, we had a rally. The community was calling into our office and saying, we need to do something. And so we hosted a peace rally and anti-hate rally, right? And so brought the community out. And it wasn't only Asian and Pacific Islander. It was also our Black community member and our Latino and our Caucasian community that came out to support. So I think people needed a space to process this. And it was really challenging because many of us were isolated, right, due to the pandemic. And so it was safe enough for us to gather with wearing our mask at that time. And it was just really needed to have a space together to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was a moment. It was, it was too close to home really for everybody as Asian Americans in this country. For those Cambodians inspired to follow your footsteps in pursuing higher education or running for public office, what advice do you have for them?
I would say that to never give up, because it's so hard. There's so many reasons to not do it. But I think that that's why your question earlier is so important, is like, why, what inspired you and why did you do it? And I think that that's the purpose that people have to hold on to really dearly in order to be able to achieve where you want to go, because it's so hard to see into the unknown in the future, right? Because you're facing with the difficulty right in front of you. And I think that as long as you keep focusing on the purpose and, you know, seeking assistance and help to do that, but to also be realistic, to do your homework and to talk to people who've done it before. You know, I'm always happy to share my experience, but it's a little harder for me to give you advice when you're in another city. I can't speak specifically to what your chances are and all of that, but I could totally speak to what I did and to share what tools I use or what who I talk to in order to continue to on that pathway, right? Because if you really want to run for office, you really need to decide that it's not about you. It's about right. serving the community. And I think that sometimes you need to be really clear, because it's really hard work. Even when you win, once you get into office, it's obviously not just smooth sailing. There's a lot of hard work and decision put before you. And so you need to make sure, you know, you're really clear on your purpose.
Right. And I think if you're going in it with a different reason or with a different agenda, I think you'll find out fairly quickly that it might not be for you.
Yeah. And that's why I think campaigning is important, because it really demonstrates the rigor of the work and the questions that you get asked and the positions you get put in. I think that you're pretty much on 24 hours a day. There's no, it's not a 9-to-5 job, right? It's a service that you do as a representative. And so every issue is your issue when you represent an area.
And are you loving your new role as councilwoman?
I am. I really am. I am so just honored and just humbled to be in this role, because while there are all these challenges you mentioned, I also just have this awesome opportunity to figure out how to resolve it and do it with other people. And that's why I did it, because I also love this kind of challenge and work. It really pushes me to continue to grow as a person, and that is what I seek, is always how to be better, a better person, a better, mom, a better, wife, a better representative. That's all we can strive to do, right, is to be better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I get that. But that also takes great self-awareness as well, to want to be mm-hmm. better.
Absolutely.
Is there anything that I didn't ask that I should have?
No, but that I always want to make sure to leave it that, people always, question where they are in their life. And I think that that's a good place to start around self-awareness, that if you're feeling you need to be at a different place, to think about, well, what does it take for me to get there and who do I need to talk to? You have complete control over the direction of where you want to go, in the sense that, and how you plan things, what sacrifices you want to make to get there, right? And so really want to bring that to attention around, in the end of the day, it's really important, no matter what you do, to think about how you can be of service to others. Whether or not you have children like me, to, having full-time jobs like me, there's always a way to serve the community one way or another. So I really encourage that, and really appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion with you and to share about myself. And I'm also, so look forward to working with many others to keep things moving forward, right? To making progress.
To add to what you just said, a friend told me once that if you look at a problem as an obstacle, you will never find the answer. But if you pose it as a challenge or an opportunity to learn, then the solution will appear.
Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes really discouraging, because sometimes things seem so hard, but that's sometimes why it's important you take breaks and come back to it, so you don't give up, right? Right. Take a break. Don't give up.
Reset.
If it's a right, exactly.
Last question. What now? What's your next political ambition?
All I can think about is just being the best council member I can be, and to changing the conditions I talked to you about earlier, and really supporting the next generation to pursuing, their dreams, meanwhile improving our community. I really can't think beyond that at the moment, because I just, I'm a mom. I want to be the best mom as well, and best wife and best daughter, right? My parents are getting older too. So I want to be conscious that I have all these multiple opportunity and be present and be happy with, where I'm at the moment, which I am.
I have learned so much from you today. Here's my conclusion. The takeaway I got from our conversation today is that the key to success starts with one's purpose. And if you are unsure of where you stand, seek out those that have traveled the path you want to take. Thank you so much, Councilwoman Sully. The best of luck on your future endeavors.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoy listening to my guest's journey from surviving to thriving as Khmer in America, and for the lessons they have learned and shared with us. For more stories like this, visit us at voacambodia.com. Until next time, I'm Manny, your host of Bayan Bayou with Manny.